Support for this public radio podcast comes from the Society for Human Resource Management, which also sponsors PBS's CEO Exchange, online at shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing money since 1937 with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
I'm not sure, but I think somebody forgot to tell the banks in this country that there might be a recession coming. Usually it's happy times that bring mergers and acquisitions, but this morning Bank of America confirmed its takeover of Countrywide, and that wasn't the only deal being bandied about today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, working to provide responsible, sustainable energy to power America's future. Constellation Energy, the way energy works.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today, the 11th of January. Glad you could be with us. Economies of scale might be a good way to describe what's going on here, because that's as good an explanation as anything else for Bank of America's decision to sink another $2 billion into Countrywide. For a total of $4 billion overall, Bank of America is going to become this country's biggest mortgage lender. It'll handle one in every four home loans. What we don't know yet is how B of A and the whole industry is going to digest the billions of dollars in sour loans that are already out there. But maybe in bad times, bigger really is better, because Countrywide wasn't the only bank deal being talked about today, as our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports.
CNBC reports J.P. Morgan Chase has begun very preliminary talks about buying another big mortgage lender, Washington Mutual. Industry consultant Bert Ely says this bonanza of bank buying is a direct result of the housing downturn and mortgage loans gone bad.
Anytime there are problems in any kind of industry, the weak get acquired by the strong. This is kind of like, you know, who's going to have a seat and who isn't when the music stops. And I can assure you the investment bankers are falling all over themselves trying to put deals together.
Bank of America executives say they got Countrywide's mortgage business at a good price, since the company's stock value has fallen nearly 90% over the past year. But analyst Jane Durista at the Financial Markets Center says Federal Reserve regulators should be worried that bigger banks could become an even bigger liability as the Fed continues to lend them cheap cash.
The unintended consequences could be quite substantial in terms of too big to fail. I mean, they are moving closer into the bosom of the Fed as it is. Is the Fed really able to deal with the financial crises at these levels? Over time, it may be that the Fed is not able to be there for them in the way that it has in the past.
And the president of the Service Employees International Union, Andy Stern, today called on the government to nix the deal.
The bigger the banks get, the worse it gets for people and communities. Higher credit card rates, it's meant higher fees, it's meant financial schemes like subprime mortgage.
But by taking on Countrywide's bad loans, Bank of America could be saving regulators the huge headache of a taxpayer-financed bailout. Even though the government has been working with banks to ease the mortgage crunch, the Treasury Department today denied and encouraged Bank of America to take over Countrywide. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Changing industries, but not topics here for just a second. The board of directors at Delta Airlines is meeting today. Merger talks are on the table there, too. The housing slump and the subprime crisis have laid ruin to a lot of credit ratings lately, from some of the country's biggest financial institutions to the millions of Americans facing foreclosure. But here is a name that has managed to emerge with a clean rating. Uncle Sam. Both Standard & Poor's and Moody's have reaffirmed their AAA ratings for bonds issued by the good old U.S. of A. The Treasury bill is widely viewed by investors as being risk-free, so it's probably worth noting that Moody's did attach a note of caution to its AAA rating, as our business correspondent Bob Moon explains.
Uncle Sam has enjoyed the highest possible credit rating ever since Moody's started its rankings in 1917, but the ratings agency is warning the government needs to start facing the music on health care and Social Security spending. In its report on the country's so-called sovereign debt rating, Moody's says the world's largest creditor risks losing its AAA rating within the decade if it doesn't get control of its entitlement programs. A spokesman for the ratings agency told Marketplace the chance of a downgrade is very remote, and he stressed it's still a long-term issue. Jagadish Gokhale is a scholar at the Cato Institute. He says the problem is much more urgent than Moody's is making it out to be.
You know, the Social Security and Medicare administrations have estimated that the imbalances of these two programs amount to something like $90 trillion. So we're looking at multiples of annual output of the U.S. that has to be sacrificed to make these programs whole, which is a huge cost.
Gokhale complains that Moody's seems to suggest there's plenty of time to fix the problem, but he figures that by acting now, the country could save more than $30 trillion. If this all sounds like something you've heard before, politicians have been talking about it for years.
The spending for these programs is growing faster than inflation, faster than the economy, and faster than our ability to pay for them.
That was President Bush almost 2 years ago. Now some analysts are saying they hope the warning from Moody's might put some pressure on candidates from both parties and make them pay more attention to the problem. In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Speaking of candidates from both parties, we're still waiting to figure out what Congress and the White House have in mind when it comes to stimulating the economy. But Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton took a shot today. Senator Clinton is proposing what could be $110 billion worth of spending and tax cuts to keep the country out of a recession. No mention, though, of how she's going to pay for it. The Iraqi economy is still a ways away from anything resembling normal, but foreign investment in Baghdad is definitely picking up. We learned today three of Iraq's biggest state-owned cement firms have signed deals with outside investors from Romania, Germany, and Lebanon. If you're sitting there right now scratching your head trying to figure out why cement might be important in Iraq, I've got one word for you: reconstruction. And on top of that, Jeremy Hobson reports the business models these deals propose may be signs of things to come for Iraqi industry.
The dream of Bush administration officials post-invasion was this: open Iraq's state-owned businesses up to the free market and investors will come swarming in. That didn't happen. The security situation was simply too risky for foreign companies. Today's news, though, marks a step toward a reasonable compromise, says Michael O'Hanlon of the Brookings Institution.
It's a small step, but I think, you know, it's a very little, very late compared to what the hopes had been for Iraq becoming the beacon of democracy and free market enterprise.
But the cement industry compromise makes sense for both sides, says Frank DuBois at American University's Kogod School of Business. For Iraqis who want to retain control of a state-owned industry,
the critical issue for them is job protection. And I think if there's state-owned component to the sources of production there, then they have a lot better bargaining power with the private companies that are bringing the technology in terms of retaining employment.
For foreign investors worried about security but still interested in tapping into an emerging economy, the production-sharing deal offers them one foot in the door until security improves. And they'll be rehabilitating existing factories. That's a lot easier than building new ones that require government approval.
One foot in the door, hopefully the door's going to open wider 2, 3, 4, 5 years down the road.
And since cement is needed for nearly everything that's being rebuilt in Iraq, foreign investors are betting the once booming cement industry could end up being quite lucrative by then. In Washington, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Oil was down today, gas was down, the trade deficit was higher, the dollar was mixed, stocks were way down. We'll have the details and a look at the whole wide week on Wall Street when we do the numbers. The other stock market story today, away from stocks and bonds, was commodities. It's been a wild ride on that side of the house. Corn and wheat prices have been hitting records. Sugar is higher. Coffee and cocoa hit multi-year highs today. And gold topped $900 an ounce at one point this morning, $900.10 to be exact, closed just a hair shy of it. We know it's not like you're going to go out and buy an ingot or anything anytime soon, but consumers and certain retailers will be feeling the pain. Marketplace's Janet Babin reports now from North Carolina Public Radio.
The price of gold's been going up for the past several years, but till now, that hasn't been a problem for jewelry store owner William Travis Kukovich.
I'm 37. My entire career in the jewelry industry has been a boom.
Then came holiday 2007. Kukovich says sales were lower than expected. He blames the weak dollar and rising gold prices.
It makes a pair of earrings, a $300 or $400 pair of earrings, which is expensive, all of a sudden are a $600 pair of earrings. So we do lose sales because of the price of gold.
And the more consumers feel squeezed by the faltering economy, the higher gold prices could go. James Turk is with GoldMoney.com.
Gold goes up because it's a barometer of inflationary pressures, and we're really seeing this today. You know, crude oil is in the 90s. Wheat is above $10 a bushel. Corn is now over $4 a bushel and rising.
Theoretically, you can't go to your local grocery store and buy that more expensive loaf of bread with gold bullion. But some financial experts see gold as a tangible asset, a safe haven in times of turmoil. And many experts think there's a lot more turmoil to go around, especially from the global credit crisis. John Thorpe is with Canon Futures Trading.
This market could go a lot higher than it currently is. And 900 is probably a stopping point on the way to the top of this mountain.
If that's the case, it could mean lots of repricing and shrinking sales for jewelers like William Travis. In Chapel Hill, North Carolina, I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
We've had a bug going around the office here at Marketplace for a month or so now. It's one of those really stubborn ones that just won't go away, which means some of us have been taking advantage of a benefit we don't really think much about, getting paid to stay home when we've got the sniffles. But maybe we ought to, because the Department of Labor says more than 40% of private sector workers don't get paid sick leave. Most of that 40% works in service jobs, like restaurants or retail. Cities in a handful of states are considering legislation to make paid sick days mandatory. There's federal legislation pending, too. And businesses in Washington, D.C. are bracing for a city council vote next month. Shia Levitt reports.
Pedro Alfonso has run Dynamic Concepts, a small telecom firm, for 3 decades. He says he already provides competitive benefits, including paid sick leave, vacation time, and a 401k plan. This works just fine, he says, but the new legislation would increase the amount of paid sick time he gives, and it would apply to many of his part-time or seasonal employees who make up almost a third of his workforce and don't get paid sick leave now.
There's increased costs associated with paying these employees. There's the burden of actually tracking part-time employees.
Alfonso would have to design new payroll procedures and pay for new software. All these changes together will cost money.
The costs associated with this could be anywhere from $500 to $1,000 per employee, multiplied times 80 or 100 employees. It's a substantial cost that has to be allocated from some other aspect of the business, either other benefits, from profits, from 401k plans.
He says many businesses would also have to figure out how much time each employee works in D.C. as opposed to Maryland or Virginia. If, say, an employee spends half his or her time in D.C., then only that time accrues paid sick leave. But advocates say the measure would also bring benefits, less spreading of illness, faster recovery time, and greater productivity. Ed Lazier runs D.C.'s Fiscal Policy Institute.
Our conclusion is that the cost to business is relatively modest, but that the benefits to business are likely to be in the same range and really offset the costs for most businesses.
Karen Kerrigan heads up the Small Business and Entrepreneurship Council. She says many places considering these new policies already rank poorly in terms of business friendliness. That includes Maine, Massachusetts, and D.C. She says they already have high taxes, fees, and mandated worker benefits.
The paid sick mandate would just be another cost, would be piling on, if you will, to these existing costs that add to a poor business climate in these states.
Maine Senate President Beth Edmonds, whose state may vote on its own paid sick leave in coming weeks, says more state and local lawmakers are pushing their own measures because congressional leaders have been dragging their feet. Edmonds says a federal bill would be better.
It'd be really great if the federal government had a position on this because it would allow businesses to feel like they were able to give this benefit, which many of them want to give, without negatively impacting them vis-a-vis competition.
Congressional efforts to mandate national paid sick days began in 2004, but have so far stalled. In Washington, I'm Shia Levitt for Marketplace.
It is time to check the week on Wall Street with the guy we do that with, David Johnson, down in Dallas, Texas. Sir, how are you?
I'm hunkering down.
Yeah, I imagine
and praying that people don't shoot the messenger.
Well, yeah, but somebody's to blame, right?
Yeah, I know. Bernanke, can we blame him?
Yeah, go ahead.
Greed? How about greed?
I like that.
There's a lot of that. And there's just a lot of fear around right now. There's that uncertainty. Just when you think you're right on the edge of finding out just how deep this hole is,
Somebody
comes along and says, well, search me.
Who did that this time?
Well, UBS, the bank. What I'm talking about, the losses are potential losses because of the credit crunch and the subprime crisis. You probably heard about all that.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I've heard about that. Yeah.
So we've got speculation that next week, the big week, when the banks are going to all report that it's going to be $12 billion or $15 billion in write-offs or $20 billion in write-offs, then along comes UBS today saying in a letter to their shareholders, quote, "We cannot at this time accurately predict the future development of U.S. residential mortgage markets and therefore the ultimate impact on our positions in some prime mortgage-related securities." Now, that was like in Schweizer Deutsche, but but in English, what that means is, search me! That's not what you need to hear.
Yeah, what are we supposed to make of all that, though?
Well, I think what you make of it is there's no reason to go in and just back up the truck right now and fill it full of equities. There's some of these guys that are doing pretty good that have held on, but today they just sort of threw in the towel. You know, but if you look at the breadth, there were 1,100 stocks up, there were 2,000 down. I mean, on a day when you're down 250 points, you'd think it'd be like 7, 8, 10 to 1 on the downside.
Well, all right. So this was one of those days where you're going to tell me it was just a couple of stocks.
Well, no. It was a whole lot of stocks. Right. But what they did is they came in and they just beat up everybody. McDonald's. I mean, it had been a darling. Stock was down almost $4. That stock took 40 points out of the down. Procter & Gamble. Nobody's ever going to wash their hands again. And nobody's ever going to buy Scotch tape again. You know, 3M was down $2.63. The only thing that was up, and this is the weird thing, the only thing that was up, by and large, were the financials. The ones that had I know. But know what's happening.
Yeah, I don't know what's happening.
Listen. You hear that?
Yeah, what?
It's kind of rumbling.
No.
It's like a timpani. You know how they start out? And then, bam! Well, that's what's happening. These financials come with their earnings next week. And that you can't just say, oh, and by the way, dear shareholders, we're increasing our loan loss reserves to $100 billion. What they're going to have to do is say it's going to be whatever it is, $12 billion, it's going to be $15 billion. However, and that's the uncertainty right now, the positive thing, the thing that's going to make me get up and come to work on Monday morning is the uncertainty. They're going to do something. They're going to bring in more capital. They're going to sell off divisions. They're going to do something. You mark my words, we'll make news next week.
Consider them marked. David Johnson down in Dallas, Texas. Thank you, David.
Have a good weekend, Kyle.
You too. Coming up, how human trafficking taints the products that we buy.
You've got cotton, coffee, sugar, timber products, steel from South America made with slave-produced charcoal.
But first, let's do the numbers. Worries about those bank write-downs that Johnson was just talking about pulled the rug out from under Wall Street today. The Dow Industrial slumped 1.9%, 246 points to close at 12,606. The Nasdaq dove 1.9%, 48 points to end at 2439. The S&P 500 gave back 1.3%, 19 points to finish the day at 1401. For the week gone by, the Dow lost 1.5%. The Nasdaq dropped 2.5%. The S&P 500 lost 0.8%. Merrill Lynch sparked those write-down worries. It fell 5% on news it might take a $15 billion hit from its subprime exposure. Bonds traded up. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.79%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Duke University's Fuqua School of Business Executive MBA programs, where working professionals earn Duke MBAs from locations around the world. Online at DukeExecutiveMBA.com. Whether you're busy or lounging around, the economic gears are always turning. Marketplace is available around the clock, too, as a podcast. Get your financial fix whenever you want it. Download the show and take it with you. Just head over to our website at marketplace.org and click on podcasts.
from the Marketplace Statebook, here's a glance at events coming up Monday. President Bush is in Saudi Arabia for a meeting with King Abdullah. Apple lovers convene in San Francisco for the annual Macworld Conference and Expo. Last year's attendance topped 40,000. And it's Andy Rooney's birthday. The 60 Minutes commentator will be 89. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. In a speech yesterday, the chairman of the Federal Reserve all but promised an interest rate cut the next time the Fed meets. Analysts and economists took some solace. Wall Street got a nice little bump. But plenty of people are still asking, what took you so long, Ben? Commentator Mark Toma says it's time to lay off the Fed.
The Bernanke Fed didn't create many of today's problems. They can be traced to the Alan Greenspan era. Low interest rates and lack of regulatory oversight during Greenspan's tenure helped to inflate the mortgage bubble. So the Bernanke Fed didn't create the problems, it inherited them. But that doesn't let the Fed off the hook completely. The Fed still has to manage the crisis it inherited. The Fed can't fix every problem the economy might experience. It can help to dislodge liquidity bottlenecks and provide stimulus through lower interest rates. But the Fed can't do much to recover what's gone once it's gone. Listening to Greenspan recently and remembering what he said in the past, it's not at all clear he would have acknowledged the severity of the housing downturn any earlier than today's Fed chairman or managed the crisis any better. But I don't think this matters much in terms of how deep the downturn will be, and I'm doubtful different leadership of the Fed would have made much of a difference. So if this is the basis for the declining lack of faith in the Fed, I think it's unfair. And there is a positive side. Market participants didn't properly account for risk. They had too much confidence in the ability of the Greenspan Fed to insulate the economy and financial markets from large fluctuations. That's why they got so exuberant. They gave the Fed too much credit for the great moderation. If current market troubles wake these participants up to the risks they face, not because they think the Fed is incapable, but because they now get the risky nature of their environment, that will put a damper on the self-feeding financial frenzies. And that would be a healthy development for us all.
Mark Toma is a professor of economics at the University of Oregon. He blogs at The Economist's View. You can find a link and you can reach us at our website. It's marketplace.org. Last year was the 200th anniversary of the Slave Trade Act of 1807. It made slavery illegal across the British Empire. In the then-new United States, it became illegal to import slaves as of January 1, 1808. But 200 years on, slavery is still a huge element of the global economy, especially in the part least visible to consumers, the long pipeline that most products have to work their way through. We've called Kevin Bales to talk about his push to clean up that corporate supply chain. He's the president of the advocacy group Free the Slaves. Mr. Bales, welcome to the program.
Hey, great to be here.
Where is the corporate line of responsibility in getting slavery out of its supply chain?
There's a legal line, and then there's also a kind of social and moral line. It's interesting that in the United States, we have a law against the importation of any product of any sort that has any kind of child labor or slave labor in it. So there's a legal responsibility there that says, according to federal law, you cannot do that. Of course, the product supply chains stretch far off into other countries. And then you have to say, well, what is our social or what is our moral responsibility to make sure that, you know, the food we get or the minerals that we bring in aren't touched by slavery in those foreign countries?
And obviously, there is a moral obligation on everybody's part. I want you, though, to pick an industry and give me an example of how that might work. How an industry here in the States might go about getting slavery out of its supply chain.
You know, I think one of the very best examples is the chocolate industry. They had to confront the fact that there was slave labor in cocoa farming in West Africa about 5-6 years ago. There was no way that they could actually go in and be the police officers in a country like the Ivory Coast. But what they did do was join together the entire industry and form a international cocoa initiative in which they bankroll the work that does the work on the ground that takes the slavery and child labor out of the cocoa production. And they do that in cooperation with human rights groups and anti-child labor groups and so forth. And that industry-wide approach in which they bring the financial resources and then other people bring the expertise to bear seems to be having a very important impact. And they've now established and about to bring online an inspection and certification system for cocoa, initially in the Ivory Coast and Ghana, that will help us to know and avoid having any of slavery in the products we use.
Take a wider look for me. Besides cocoa, what other industries are wrapped up in slavery in their supply chain, and what are they doing?
Well, you've got cotton, coffee, sugar, timber products, steel from South America made with slave-produced charcoal. One of the things that we're working on a lot right now is tantalum, the mineral that goes into cell phones and laptops. Most of those industries are beginning to work through the supply chain and begin to try to find an inspection system. But I have to tell you that for the most part, there's nothing like what the chocolate industry has done in terms of bringing together an industry-wide solution. The real challenge here is that while there's slavery in these commodities, it only is in a very tiny proportion of those commodities. So if there's slavery in cocoa, it probably accounts for only 1 to 2% of West African cocoa. And that's what makes it like looking for a needle in a haystack.
You have talked about the economic upside to ending slavery, and it sort of seems self-evident on its face, but lay out that argument for us.
Well, what we have been trying to measure very carefully over the last few years and work in several parts of the world is the freedom dividend. Because what we began to notice is that while we were going in to help people come out of slavery and work with them to build economically autonomous lives in freedom, they really began to produce, and their incomes shoot up. They do what they've always wanted to be, which is to be consumers. But we're watching an economic spiral as you set these workers free to be active members of the economic society they belong to.
Kevin Bales is the president of an organization called Free the Slaves. Mr. Bales, thanks so much for your time.
Hey, it's been great to be here.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of a well-diversified college savings plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, Pat Robertson is looking to become a newspaper man. He's already a broadcaster, of course. In an email released to the press today, the founder of the Christian Broadcasting Network said he's considering making an offer for the Virginian Pilot. The Pilot is owned by Landmark Communications in Norfolk, Virginia. It's the local paper there. Landmark said last week it's thinking about selling off its assets, which include the Weather Channel. The whole thing, Weather Channel and all, is on the block for $5 billion. Robertson says that's a little rich for his blood. He did say the paper, however, could provide some added value for his other assets, like internships for journalism students from Regent University. That's the private Christian university that he founded a number of years ago. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Friday afternoon. The stock market does not give us good tidings for the weekend. The Dow dropped 246 points today, 1.9%. The NASDAQ shed 48 points, 1.9% there as well. The S&P 500 lost 18 points. That works out to 1.25% there. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Coming up on Monday, tutorials for women working in Iran.
If they say, why are you wearing makeup? You say, I don't wear makeup for men. If they say, your socks are too thin, you say, but my hijab is long.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.